This podcast is sponsored by Bel Gioioso Cheese. Bel Gioioso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh, local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft a full line of exceptional cheeses, guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Bel Gioioso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Bel Gioioso, every cheese is a specialty. Hi, and welcome to Extra Serving, an award-winning podcast by Nation's Restaurant News. I'm your host, Holly Petrie. Today on the pod, we're going to be talking about the increase in menu customization, Starbucks' latest woes, and McDonald's latest menu test. On Takeaway with Sam Okus, Sam talked with the co-founders of Indian Fast Casual Rasa, Sahil Rahman and Rahul Vinod. And be sure to check out First Bite, our daily morning podcast where I dissect the top news of the day alongside an editor and editor. And now it's time to introduce my co-hosts.
I'm Sam Okus, Editor-in-Chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
I'm Joanna Fantozzi, Senior Editor with Nation's Restaurant News.
Welcome, Joanna. We haven't had you on in forever.
I know. Hi.
Fill us in. What have you been up to?
I'm yelling.
Just move this thing back.
Been up to, Joanna?
Well, we went to D.C. this week.
We sure did.
We met some great operators there. So
and it was your first trip to D.C., which
it was my first trip to D.C., yes.
Very and surprising.
I didn't actually go inside any touristy areas, but I took pictures in front of the White House and the Capitol and the Washington Monument.
Yeah. You have lived like 2 hours from that city your whole life. I can't believe you've never.
2 hours. 3.5.
Like 4 hours.
Half hour flight, to be fair. So, but still, you've lived so close. It's taken you all these years.
I don't know. I never got to go as a kid. There was like I couldn't go in eighth, or it was supposed to be our eighth grade field trip. And then it was canceled because of 9/11.
Right.
And then my senior field trip was to DC and I didn't get to go because I had the flu. And just since then, I just never went.
So
went elsewhere.
Escaped you. It's escaped you for all these years, and you finally got to go.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know it's a super cool city.
Yeah, it was really easy to get around, which I appreciated. I feel like it was easier to like understand really than Denver.
Unless you're driving a car, the streets in Washington, D.C. are the nuttiest, craziest, every which wayiest roads I have ever driven on in my life.
They're so wide. And like the sidewalks are so wide.
Well, but, and there's also like these, like all these like 5-point intersections and diagonals. And I drove not this trip, but 5 or 6 years ago, I drove into DC and it was not my favorite as a driver. Driving in Manhattan is, while busier, a lot more easy to understand clearly because New York is a grid in ways that DC is not.
Yeah. But New York, I would never drive in New York. It's just, I feel like it's so scary.
It's a little scary. It is definitely a little scary. But anyway, we were in DC. Why, Holly? Do you want to tell the lovely listeners?
We were in DC for this emerging restaurant series that we're calling the Create Roadshow that is here for emerging restaurateurs, established restaurateurs, independent restaurateurs, everyone alike. We're here for you to build a community. And we started the Roadshow in DC. We're going to be in several cities next year. Surprise, surprise. You'll find out about them later. We will announce them, I'm sure, on the podcast. But for now, it's a secret. And we're going to be coming to cities near you. We're going to be coming to you to give you a chance to have community, to give you a chance to have a spot where you'll have free drinks, where you'll have a chance to network with people in your community, and you get out of your own bubble and just get a chance to really talk with people and share ideas and share what tech stack you're using. Share, that was something we learned from Create, was like people just talking to each other and saying, what tech stack are you using? How do you operate with a 4-day work week? How do you split your tips among all your staff? Like these are things that people just get together and they talk about. And we heard a lot of the same conversations at the DC Roadshow too. And so it's really great to just get together and talk with your fellow operators and just really get to know what's happening in the local community, and you get to make some contacts and you get to meet us. we're all there. You get to meet the interim editors and hear from us and hear an inside look at what we think and what we're doing. It's really exciting. It was super fun. I can't wait for next year. Did I do a good job, Sam?
You did very good. Well done. I was just about to say we should put you on a billboard. You did a very nicely done. Yeah, I mean, these events are, excuse me, they're just a really great opportunity and easy opportunity, I would say, because you don't have to go much further than a bar in your community to meet with people who can help you do your job better. At the end of the day, I think everybody wants to learn and grow in their business. And that's what we hope to provide, is just a venue to be able to do that. And so while we are doing Create every year as an annual thing, and next year we'll be in Palm Springs and you should come hang out with us there October 2nd through 4th, 2023. If you can't make it to Palm Springs, at least come join us at one of these roadshow events, because you'll find a lot of value connecting with your fellow restaurant operator and connecting with us. I mean, we couldn't believe we met people there who had 10 locations of a restaurant we've never heard of. I mean, for us, we're very much, I want to say we're insulated because we follow this industry every single day, but we are only in our, individual parts of this country, and it gets us, we had to get out to get to know some of these restaurants that have incredible potential, are already doing incredible things. And yet just because, they're maybe a little bit, they're a little bit of a diamond in the rough at this point. You know, we haven't really been able to talk about them in NRN or give them the platform, I guess you could say, that they deserve.
Yeah. And not only is it a place to meet up with people and hang out, but we also had a great panel hosted by Sam. And completely coincidentally, the people on the two of the folks on the panel were our friends from RASA.
Who are on my podcast this week.
It's just like a circle of life.
Oh my gosh. It's like we planned it that way.
I know. That's why I said completely coincidentally.
Wink. Yes. And they're awesome. And the other two, Bettina Stern and Suzanne Simon, co-founders of Chaya Tacos, also awesome. We had a great chat about what it means to be an emerging restaurant concept in DC. This is, again, something we'll do in the other cities we visit next week or next year when we host these, is sit down with a few local leaders and really get into the nitty gritty, because, local folks have a better handle on what are some unique challenges to that area. I think that's what we want these panels to do, is really talk about what it means to be a restaurant operator in DC, an emerging restaurant operator. So we had a blast with that, all around really good time. Holly and I ate at several restaurants as we got some footage for another edition of our Emerging Brands to Watch in the city. And we're very full. We were very full at the end of it.
Still full.
Always full. Yep.
Always full now. It's our jobs.
Tough job. Tough
life. I will say, though, that my friend that I only had tea there, but it was delicious. But our my friend that I met up with after the team breakfast did chastise us a little bit for going to Founding Farmers, because he said it is a very touristy place.
Was he giving us breakfast recommendations?
But I thought that the tea I had was really good. Didn't taste very touristy. So.
Well, they're a great group of restaurants. I mean, yes, they're right exactly located where all the tourists are. But there's a great story behind those restaurants too. At least they're not some soulless corporate whatever restaurants.
They are. Be calling the people that we write about soulless, but
not that there are any soulless corporate restaurant groups in this country. Nope, not a one.
Oh boy.
No comment over here, even though I had literally a picture in my mind of something when you said that, and I went, had an example, and I was like, probably shouldn't say it.
Ruh-roh. Nope. Let's keep that to ourselves.
Okay. I'm sorry. I get you guys in trouble when I'm on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Joanna. Anyway, that's enough of Joanna Fantozzi. Thanks for joining us today, Joanna. Out you go. Never invited again.
We're kidding, Joanna. You're lovely to have on the podcast.
Hey, try.
We'll make that decision when we're done. Thank you very much. Evaluated this podcast. Yeah, we'll see how you do. All right. Well, Madam Host, shall we talk about the news?
Yes, let's talk about the news. Let's talk about menu customization. Because there's been an increase in menu customization across a lot of brands like Panera and IHOP recently. So what do you guys think about this trend? Because we've seen an increase in menu customization. We've also seen an increase in the opposite. We've also seen an increase in menu stabilization. I don't know what you'd call it. What would you call
signature, it? Signature choices is what you would call choices. The opposite. Yeah, I mean, that's how I typically would say it. Yeah.
So because we've seen places like Subway take away their customization. So we've seen places that haven't had customization add it, and we've seen a lot of that. But then we've seen places that are known for customization take it away. So what do you guys think about this kind of trend that's happening and this reverse trend that's happening? I mean, it seems customization is kind of the it thing right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because it is kind of, I mean, completely counter to what we talked about back when Subway launched their signature series. Because I theorized at the time that customization was dead. So imagine my surprise when I found out I was wrong, because I'm never wrong. But I would just say a few caveats here, which is that customization is a fairly loose term here, because, you know, there's customization that Subway was doing. And then there's some of the customization that these other restaurants that you mentioned are doing, which are not entirely, it's not build your own menu item. It's a lot of it's assemble your own meal, right? And so what I think about this is I do think, you know, one word that jumps to mind is flexibility. So flexibility and choice are not totally synonymous with customization, but they are in the same realm, which is to say that customization is all about having your choice as to what you want. But flexibility is more about, like, you have the option to do something different if you so choose, but it's up to you, right? I have never really enjoyed those places where I have to customize, because I would prefer the option of not. I think it's easier to say, I want the number, whatever. I trust your chef who has put this together. I don't trust my own taste. So I think that this is more about flexibility than it is about true customization. And the last thing I'll say is I think it's about value. All of this seems to be about, you know, there's some bundling stuff going on. There are sort of build your own package kind of things. And I think this is a way to communicate value to the customer who, you know, doesn't, if the inflation is sending prices so high and yet, you know, brands want to win on the value conversation, they can't just slash their prices because of inflation. They can give you flexibility to assemble your meal in a new fun kind of way. And I think that's where this customization trend is. It's not build your own menu item, such as it is assemble your own meal experience.
I think also true customization, like the definition of it, meaning that like the build your own menu items and kind of being able to DIY your meal. I think that would be detrimental to a lot of restaurants right now, just because there are still a lot of supply chain and labor issues. So I think that the Chipotleization of kind of being able to, like, build your meal and kind of the assembly line thing, I think that will be tough for restaurants that are dealing with supply chain and staffing challenges.
Well, and for example, when we go into restaurants for our emerging chain series, when we are going into restaurants and we're picking out these emerging restaurants and we're going in and we're ordering things, we're always ordering pre-made signature items. We're never customizing. And most of these chains have the option to customize, and we never, ever customize.
Yeah, I mean, I think for particularly new customers, the experience you want them to have, clearly you want them to have a good experience. And my impression of a restaurant is, yes, you can offer customization, but you must also have the option of not customizing, because if you have a new customer come in, they're not familiar maybe with the flavors or whatever. I'd say a good example related to what you're saying was, Holly, when we went to Tokabe in Denver, because Tokabe, which, if you haven't listened to my episode of Takeaway with Ben Jacobs, co-founder of Tokabe, go do that because he's awesome. The Tokabe's model is that you can customize your own meal, But if you don't want to, you have signature options there to choose from. And it's Native American cuisine, which I am not an expert in by a long shot. And so when we walked in there, I was intimidated by building my own meal. And I saw the signature items. And even beyond that, I asked the cashier what he would suggest. Excuse me. And he offered great suggestions. He pointed me to some of the signature items. And that's what we got. And I loved it. So anyway, point being is that your loyal customers are going to be better at understanding your menu enough to customize it the way they want it, because they've had it over and over and they know what's good and what's not. But you have new customers come in who aren't familiar. They need a starting point, and that's where the signature item should come in.
This is not to say that our new editor, Alicia, who wrote the story on customization, didn't come up with an interesting, didn't point out an interesting trend at all. I think that it's kind of almost like the new evolution, the next evolution of customization, that, like you said, I think, Sam, that the word flexibility kind of comes to mind.
Definitely. It's definitely this like option to like, almost like being a flexitarian, that like there's this option to have a little bit of both, a little bit of an option to have a little bit of your plant-based, but also a little bit of your meat. Like it's a little bit of your, a little bit of everything. All right, now I think it's time to talk about the dreaded topic on everyone's mind, Sam's least favorite topic on this podcast.
What? Starbucks. Ugh. They make so much. There's just so much Starbucks news. I'm just like, no offense, Starbucks, but
I feel I have to write it all.
Yeah, that's why we brought you on today, Joanna. I'm so tired of talking about Starbucks. I just want you to do it.
I am fine with that. So the latest in the developing tensions, rising tensions / all-out war between Starbucks and its union is that employees at a South Carolina Starbucks filed a defamation lawsuit against the coffee chain because this summer a manager at this Starbucks where these people worked claimed that they filed a police report claiming that they kidnapped / assaulted her. And then in a TikTok video, it kind of showed that she basically just brushed past them, the manager, and there was no kidnapping or assault. And so the police said, never mind, this is not an actual issue, but Starbucks never actually dropped the accusations. So they are kind of filing this defamation lawsuit now. If you hadn't been following all the drama, then that is the latest.
The latest on the saga. That is dramatic, though.
It's bonkers. This stuff is just crazy. It's like, you know, and it's getting so far away from even being about unionizing anymore. It just feels like it's a war at this point. It's like the bad blood between these two sides. And this is such an example of how not to do this, right? I mean, you know, a lot of our listeners are probably not dealing with stores trying to unionize, but you need to have an understanding of sort of how to respond to it if this comes up, because it could. And just look at Starbucks and know not what not to do. It's just been my impression of things, because it just has gotten so ugly. And it feels like Starbucks at a lot of turns here has kind of poured some fuel on the flames in some ways. It's like they've gone pretty directly at the workers' organization or whatever. But anyway, Joanna, I don't know, like, where does it go from here? Because it's just ugly.
Thing that I do kind of feel like this is something that restaurants are going to have to learn from, that I think that a lot of people in the restaurant industry are watching and taking notes. Again, like you said, unionization is still pretty new in the restaurant industry. I think that you kind of have to have an organization of a specific size or location, or obviously not people that are franchised, to even lean toward unionization at all. But yeah, I think that it will be interesting to see how the incoming Starbucks CEO handles this, because right now it's just the Schultz show. And he is pretty blatantly, even more so than his predecessor, Kevin Johnson, he's pretty blatantly just said, like, no, we don't want unionization, and has even said that they are. I don't want to quote it directly because I don't remember exactly what he said, but he said that they are bad for the company. Basically said that they are, I don't remember, now I'm mad that I can't remember exactly what word he used, but he used a derogatory word to, he called them a derogatory word. It wasn't like a
slur.
It wasn't a slur or something we'd have to bleep out on here, but I don't remember exactly what he said. But anyway, the new, the incoming CEO is supposed to be starting in April. So it'll be interesting to see if he will kind of stay the course or if he will kind of lighten up the vitriol between Starbucks and SB Workers United.
Or the discourse, right? Like if he can bring a little bit of levity to the discourse here and try to bring the two sides a little bit closer together, because I mean, it's also just bad, not just bad optics, but it's also bad for the unionization itself if you're giving the union more reasons and you're giving your employees more reasons to turn against you, right? Like, that's just been my impression of this, is that if employees at non-unionized stores watch how Starbucks has responded to things and are angered by that, then they might be more inclined to unionize. So it's very peculiar.
Yeah, I definitely think that they are kind of biting their nose to spite their face, as my mom used to would say. Yeah. I think that they will. I think that they'll regret this because right now, basically, like as someone that writes about Starbucks, they're constantly in the news. They're the latest development in the union relations. It's constantly in the news. I think that it's impossible to turn that spotlight off at this point. I think everyone's watching Starbucks's response to the union. And at this point, it really does look like the union, you know, you can't help but sympathize or empathize with them. And it looks like Starbucks is coming across as the evil empire type. Even though in many of the scenarios that I have written about, some of the union members have done things that are wrong. Like they have illegally recorded managers, for example, and they were fired for a couple of folks, employees were fired for that. So that's illegal in certain states that have a two-party system. What is that called? What's that law called?
Two-party consent.
Two-party consent, yes. You know, it's not like they are 100% always in the right, the union, but they come across that way because of Starbucks' extreme reaction.
Well, you know what kind of flew under the radar this week is that Brian Nichol made some comments on the unions for Chipotle, and that kind of flew under the radar. And he made some comments at like a Yahoo conference, about the fact that like it's such a shame that the union had to be formed and that like it's a stain on the company and that it shouldn't have happened, and that it's bad for like it's just such a shame that the union had to form and that like it shouldn't be happening. And it wasn't a big story. No one really covered it. We didn't cover it, and nobody else really covered it except for Yahoo, really. And so I found it so peculiar that, you know, Chipotle is kind of getting away with a lot more than Starbucks ever really could have. And I find it really interesting to watch the two kind of parallels with each other.
Well, I don't think it's any secret how Brian Nichol's going to feel on the unionization stuff, right? I mean, this is a pretty black and white issue when it comes to whether a business is supportive of its employees forming a union. He didn't say anything too insensitive. Like, you know, what he said was pretty much what every CEO would believe about their own employees unionizing. Now, I do think you're right though, Holly, in that Chipotle, Chipotle probably has better, maybe brand equity going into this, just in terms of like, as a mainstream story, as a public sort of rooting for one side or the other, Chipotle might have an easier job of, not getting a bunch of people riled up about it just because they have had such a great reputation for so long. But it just, you know, TBD, because only one of their restaurants has unionized so far. So as more unionize and as it becomes more, there are, you know, stakes become higher, we'll see how Chipotle reacts to it. If they can react more professionally than Starbucks, then they will have merited, you know, a little bit more of a tempered mainstream response, I guess you could say, which is what they've gotten so far.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, now time to talk about something fun. McDonald's by Krispy Kreme.
Hold
McDonald's
on a second.
McDonald's is going to start selling Krispy Kreme.
Oh, wait. I thought you said McDonald's buying Krispy Kreme. I'm like, no. That was not the news. No.
I said McDonald's buy Krispy Kreme. Like, you know, like
ex
Krispy Kreme.
Fake news.
What?
McDonald's buying Krispy Kreme.
Oh. Like, no, that's very real. It's very much happening.
Yes, that is definitely more fun than the latest in the Starbucks war against its union.
And to clarify, if it hasn't already been clarified, McDonald's and Krispy Kreme are partnering in locations in Louisville, Kentucky to sell Krispy Kreme donuts at McDonald's locations.
Which is very exciting. It's fun. That's fun news. I never thought that would happen. There are two companies that I didn't think would really combine ever. They don't really, they're not from the same location, which is usually how that these partnerships start. It's usually like they're headquartered in the same location. They're usually near each other somehow. So I find that really interesting. I like Louisville as an example. It's where Alicia lives, our newest writer. So it's very exciting that we have somebody on the ground in Louisville here to test out these new donuts at McDonald's. I mean, they're Krispy Kreme donuts, so it's not like they're new to the world. But
nothing to test. They'll be delicious.
Yeah.
I mean, she has to taste test them and make sure that they're okay.
Sure. I mean, making sure that the quality is there if you get it from a McDonald's versus getting it at a Krispy Kreme.
Obviously. But I'm very interested to see how these are going to play into sales for the breakfast category, because I feel like that's probably where they're going to be pushing them. Is it the breakfast category?
Yeah, I mean, it makes a ton of sense, I think, for McDonald's, because McDonald's obviously has been a player in breakfast for eons and has been investing a lot in the breakfast day part in the last decade in particular. But to partner with a Krispy Kreme, not only do you partner with incredible brand equity that this is like the king of the donut category, and people love Krispy Kreme, they know Krispy Kreme, and they will travel for Krispy Kreme. But also it means that McDonald's doesn't have to invest in its own donut platform. They don't have to invest in the equipment and the ingredients, the SKUs to do their own donut. So it becomes very much a win-win in that they can promote themselves as the destination for Krispy Kremes without having to have that huge investment in the process of making donuts. But, you know, for Krispy Kreme, of course, Krispy Kreme doesn't have nearly the kind of footprint that McDonald's does in terms of brick and mortar locations. So if this would have become something that went national, you know, it makes me think of like the Red Robin Donato's partnership, you know, where Red Robin started serving Donato's kind of as a ghost kitchen. You know, Donato's, what they get out of that is a much wider reach without having to invest in the brick and mortar, right? That's what Krispy Kreme gets out of this. Now, any relationship like this comes with risk, which is that, you know, you're hitching your wagon to this other cart that could go off the rails, or, you know, if something happens with McDonald's or Krispy Kreme, you know, then the other partner in this could get dragged into that. Like, say there's some donut food safety outbreak, you know, suddenly McDonald's is in the thick of it because they partner with Krispy Kreme. I don't see that, any of that kind of stuff happening. We've got two pretty iconic American brands that are partnering with each other, but I'll be interested to see how this goes because, you know, who knows? Maybe McDonald's kicking tires. Maybe they're looking at some acquisitions down the road. I'm purely speculating. I have no information to say that that's what's happening here. But, you know, co-branding, I'll let Joanna take over here in a second because you wrote the story on this. Co-branding is a really fruitful way to not only expand your product mix, but and also give customers another reason to come visit your physical location. But it's also a good way to just create some relationships that, who knows, maybe someday down the road, you are more than just co-brand partners. Maybe you are committed in a relationship as a corporate parent.
Oh boy. yeah, I think co-branding has been huge.
All right, Joanna, talk, take over.
Like, I'm done. That was your kicker. So I think that, yeah, I think co-branding has been huge lately. Particularly with like what I wrote about was just like obviously brands that are still that are under the same umbrella. So Fat Brands and Focus Brands kind of pairing their various companies together. So this is kind of a little bit different, but something that I am curious about is, will this be McDonald's's last collaboration with Jab? Could there be more Jab partnerships? That is my curiosity.
Yeah, I knew he was going to say that. I knew I was waiting for it. I was literally sitting here waiting for it.
I think we brought this up on this podcast before, but if somebody
Maybe
who knows,
I wasn't there. Sorry, I didn't. I guess it's JAB because yeah, they capitalize. So
yeah, but anyway, Jab. That's, you know, you're taking a jab at Jab.
Okay. I'm taking a jab at. Oh boy.
Oh boy.
So JAB. I would be curious if there would be any more. Collaborations with McDonald's. I mean, this is probably kind of fantastical because I feel like the answer would be probably not, but I could definitely see maybe a Caribou Coffee collab, since McDonald's is obviously known for its coffee. The thing I wouldn't probably would say, yeah, not really to is Panera. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see kind of how this relationship evolves in the future, and maybe they will delete the dating apps off of their phone and go exclusive.
Nice. There you go, Joanna.
Continue your turn.
Welcome to the Metaphor Club.
I hate this.
Holly's miserable.
I hate this. Where's Leanne?
Leanne knows how to rein it in.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you guys are driving me crazy. All right, well, I think it's time to wrap this up because there are too many metaphors here and it's a little scary. So I'm going to throw it over to Brett for this week's interview, which is Adam Baird of the Habit Burger Grill. So thank you guys so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Holly.
Bye.
This podcast is sponsored by Bel Gioioso Cheese. Bel Gioioso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh, local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft a full line of exceptional cheeses, guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Bel Gioioso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Bel Gioioso, every cheese is a specialty.
So Adam Baird, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, you know, just busy with some of the changes that have occurred with the acquisition from Yum Brands a few years ago, at the onset of the pandemic. It's always interesting. I mean, you know, our dine-in has slipped a little bit down, obviously, like everyone else is the new normal. Mm-hmm. Which lends to a little bit more creative aspects in terms of like limited time offerings, testing, and the benchmarks we had previously had prior to the pandemic. But you know, we, like everyone else, and I guess a lot of other industries, were just adapting and adjusting, and obviously the third party business has grown substantially with DoorDash and all of the others. That seem to have taken over that segment of dine-in that, at least on the West Coast, we don't have as much as we had before. So, but we're hanging in there. You know, I mean, it's commodities are really tough right now. I mean, we're facing the same thing everyone else is facing. You know, I mean, whether it's paper goods and you're shorted and you don't have logoed stuff, or whether it's excessive commodity pricing with chicken and things that are sort of at their all time high right now. And that is something I've never seen in my career. So, you know, we're adjusting to whatever we can do to combat that, as well as we can. So that's, you know.
Yeah, and you've been doing this for a while. Your title is it corporate chef at the Habit Burger Grill? What is your title, Adam?
Well, it's actually, I've actually been with the Habit since 2012. So that's 10 years, basically. I came in as a VP of food and beverage and purchasing, and then I migrated the purchasing out over to a consultant who works full time with us. Is just too much bandwidth, you know, with the growth. But yeah, and then corporate chef, essentially, all the menu development runs through me, whether it's sides, entrees, shakes, new burger builds, sandwich builds, salad builds. We have a pretty good seasonal flow on how we do our offerings, you know.
Yeah, you just recently brought back your grilled peach salad, right?
Yeah, we did. Actually, it's the first time we've done that. We tested it. Last year, we did a grilled asparagus salad, which actually, honestly, we had never done that. We're getting a little bit more traction from non-fried side items. For example, like that's a busy station for us. We'll do things with our tempura green bean, like we have a sriracha lime sauce that we, and a seven spice that we'll do as a side. But of course, sriracha is not available right now. We have this, but we've done more. Now we're going to do a roasted garlic cauliflower. We've done very, very successful with the Brussels sprouts. So non-fried items that we can kind of prepare and marinate and get ready, and then the cook time and execution is not as challenging as adding another thing to the fry station. After we really added the golden chicken bites and our double breaded chicken fillet, really maxed out the fry station area. So we're very cautious about that in terms of operations and really in that area.
And were those rolled out last year or the year before? I lose track, as everyone has.
Yeah, I mean, we just rotate them. I mean, essentially what we do is, you know, we do about seven windows a year, seven to eight, let's say, and typically 6 to 8 weeks for LTO entrees. Sometimes at the beginning of the year, we'll do a salad, or like, you know, we've done our superfood salad. We've done a few things up front in the January kind of window. Ahi a little bit, but then generally what's new news, like we're getting back to more innovation during the pandemic. I mean, obviously we fell back on testing and innovation just because it was almost impossible to read the sales and information on test. And not only that, people were gravitating much towards comfort foods. They were getting those meal kits that you cook at home, you know, like Blue Toke or whatever they are. And we just noticed that, and obviously the third party grew. So I mean, we did something like a patty melt that did very well, very, very well in the pandemic, main part of the pandemic, on a corn rye. But typically what we'll do is run, you know, one to two salads, one to two sandwiches. And then right now we're getting back to be more gourmet burger based for next year. We're still writing the 2023 calendar. Rotate shakes, two or three shakes, like I said, two or three sides, seasonal beverage. We'll do two of those a year. So, I mean, it's a good blend of innovation. Often once a year, we'll maybe do something off our core menu during the end of the year, which is a smaller window and it's more gift cards and that type of stuff. But we found that when we run our core menu items also for LTOs, that they do increase. We look at per 100 entrees. So basically for 100 people, we look at, you know, if five people are 6.0 out of 100 are buying something, it's fairly good. I mean, that's pretty good. And that's kind of our benchmark, which, like I had said, has moved around a little bit in the last few years.
Everyone's benchmarks have moved around, but you're the one to introduce the chicken bites or tenders with, I think you called them cridges, right? There were extra little crunchy bits attached to the bacon, to the chicken. That was you guys, right?
Yeah, that was a funny name that we came up with, but yeah. So actually we when I was looking at that, we kind of had I'll just call it kind of a generic kids chicken bite. It was almost similar to what you'd see in most places, the sort of cut out product. And I wanted to get with an all natural chicken product, which we did. It's actually hand cut. So we introduced chicken bites and the chicken filet sandwich, the crispy golden chicken. It's the same exact formula, but it's double breaded. And then I have them, it's almost like when you do a tempura at the end, like at a sushi restaurant, you get the little bits.
Mm-hmm.
Batter system kind of floats on top at the end of the double breading process. And it gives it what I guess we call cridges, but yeah, it's a nice crunchy product, very well seasoned. It actually was popular enough that, you know, we had a custom made, it originally, you know, hand breading it was a challenge and we don't have a breading station, but we did use the same recipe and same formulation for both those items. So, they've done very well. They've continued to do pretty well. And if and when we promote them like a Buffalo or Nashville type that we're kind of playing around with testing, it'll be incremental to that area. We're not a fried chicken house, but what we have is very good. And so I was always under the impression that if I'm going to do something that in that competitive world with all of these brands out there, we did competitive analysis and felt, you know, ours is pretty good. So don't do something that just to put it on there, because it's very competitive, obviously, with the, I guess the, they call them the chicken wars or whatever they are, but
I don't call it chicken wars.
I don't either. I think it's yeah. I mean, yeah. It is what it is, but it's very competitive in that area. But trying to fill the gaps in on the menu part of it, you know, you've got to find what flavor systems you don't have. Where we've expanded a little bit more for what we call food fans. With flavor seekers to get a little more spice, a little bit more ethnic, whether it be a sesame chicken salad, whether it be something more Italian oriented, like a caprese. We did a chicken caprese that did very well on our, you know, we added an artisan ciabatta a few years ago that replaced kind of an older hoagie style roll. And then bringing, you know, infusing a little bit more bakery in, corn rye, marble rye, brioche is something obviously that has taken off in the last 5 years, but it is popular, kind of lends a little bit more gourmet, like it's more obviously more upscale. I mean, it's brioche, it's not standard sponge or seeded bun, but because we toast all of our buns to order. And so that's kind of an orchestration that really helps the finished product, in terms of texture and flavor. So, it's been interesting to experience the last few years, but I think, it seems as if people are exploring a little bit more. They're getting back to a little bit more normalcy in terms of, hey, I'll try that. Or hey, that, how long is that on the menu for? And I'd love to come in a couple times for that item. Like the grilled peach salad, for example. That's kind of where we are with the way we look at things right now.
Well, it's interesting that people are playing with non-fried items, because as you said, at the height of the pandemic, people just wanted to eat food that was not good for them. That would make them
Yeah, I know people who either lost weight or gained weight.
Yes. I didn't leave my apartment for 13 months, basically, because I live in New York City.
You live in the city. Yeah, I know. Yeah, jeez.
So, but I maintain my weight by eating my own cooking. So, you know.
Good. Yeah. Well, you look good.
Since then, I've joined a gym, but thank you.
That's good. Yeah, no, I mean, I was the same. I kind of didn't go overboard either way. I mean, you know, I'm sure the world of, well, we use Teams a lot, but Zoom and all these things are just, you know, you find yourself, you know, because we weren't going into our offices. So you find yourself at your house, which I can't keep sit still. I'm in my, I have a test kitchen. So I was coming in here, but you find yourself on these calls all day, just literally all day. And it just, it's mind-boggling, but it largely I think people are kind of used to it, so you don't see as many people, and you run into someone, hey, I haven't seen you in 2 years.
Right, exactly.
Oh my goodness. But anyhow, so we're getting through it, but the West Coast dine-in is still particularly low, in and around 30%.
Well, it's a good thing you guys have takeout and stuff. So in the world of non-fried items, I think in February, you guys introduced garlic roasted Brussels sprouts. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, we're introducing it in the fall system wide, but we tested it then. Yeah. We tested it then. So sorry, getting off tangent, but the way we've kind of developed that is we can prepare the items and portion them and get them ready to go. I mean, if you're going to cook cauliflower or Brussels sprouts to order, it's 8 minutes. I mean, our ticket time, we want to target 7. So we can do a nice par, control the seasoning, cool it down properly, marinate it, and then just reflash it real quick on our flat griddles. And, you know, I'm looking at, I mean, I can just say, some of the other tests are snap peas, shishito peppers. We've done edamame before, but it wasn't that well received test-wise. But things like snap peas with a little Asian glaze, or a shishito with a soy garlic glaze, those types of things. They're blistered on our flat grill. Cook about 350 there. And I mean, honestly, people really like them. I mean, I don't know what the limit is or how far reaching we can get, but I mean, it does provide an option that's not off the same station, which again is a very, very busy station. 8 out of 10 people get a fried item when they get a burger, obviously fries, but we have the onion rings with panko breading, and the tempura green beans do very well, sweet potato fries. Now you've got the golden chicken components, and it's a very challenging station. So that's kind of led us to other avenues to get to, and those of which are with vegetables and using other forms of cookery than just frying everything.
Why do you suppose the edamame didn't do that well? Because it's you have to peel them? I mean, that's...
No, I mean, you know... It did. So ironically, so the edamame, we did an Asian, like a sesame ginger chicken salad, and we had edamame on it. That was already, you know, I got it in already as seeded, like not seeded, but it was, yeah. And then griddled it and all that. And that did fine. People loved it. But the one time we tested, I'm probably going to revisit it. The one time we tested, the one that you kind of pull out of, you know, you eat a Japanese restaurant or something. It just didn't, at the time, it was kind of the first time we were playing around with that. So maybe I have actually a funny note to revisit that, because it's always still popular. I mean, some people like it just with a little sea salt. Some like it with spice. I mean, I like it, edamame myself, but so that's a revisit. And now that we've sort of established ourselves, at least within our, you know, the fast casual environment, upscale kind of, now that we've kind of established some of these other items, I think it's probably, that would be something to revisit. But I was particularly surprised at some of the ones that we've tested and will be launching. So yeah, it's interesting to know that.
So how do you define doing well for a non-fried item? I assume you don't expect them to come near to competing with like French fries or onion rings or things like that.
Well, let's just say, Yeah, I mean, let's say this. Like, let's say 8 out of 10 people get French fries. You know, say 7 or 8 out of 10 people get French fries. If, in terms of the sales. And then it's divided pretty closely. Onion rings are pretty much, I mean, they fall off a little bit, but second, tempura green beans, third, you know, they're kind of right neck and neck, those more specialty items. But the way we look at it is, I mean, so something that is, at least in the current state, something that's 3.0 or higher per 100 people that eat is pretty good. It's incremental. It's pretty good. And then we also have to track, you know, how it pulls or what does it pull from? Does it pull from anything? And what we've kind of found, at least in my analysis and some of the people that helped me with that, is it doesn't pull from fried items. It doesn't necessarily, it may pull slightly from side salads or something, which we don't sell a lot of, even though they're good. And it just is a little bit incremental, and people are a little surprised, I think, to see something like a roasted garlic cauliflower, a balsamic caramelized Brussels sprout, something like that. And they're sort of like, wow, cool. Cause you know, we have a good share. Part of it also too is we're very close to about 52-48 male female skew, inclusive, obviously, family, but you know, so it lends, and the day parts are pretty equal. So it lends to offering some things that different demographics would possibly look at and be surprised that we could do that, you know, wow, and do it pretty well. So it
sounds like they're not giving up on their fries. They're just adding some vegetables to it.
Or they're trying something different. I mean, you know, I don't have a crystal ball on that, but I can tell you, I think people get a little, you know, I think when they come into the habit, whether they're regular guests or they're new to it, they're surprised because the menu does have quite a bit of variety to it. And they're like, I have a sushi grade ahi tuna. I have a tenderloin sandwich, you know, wow, okay, that's kind of interesting. And we also customize so much that, you know, we're not a brand that's going to say, oh, no, we can't do that. We're going to say either we fix something that went wrong right away, or we let you kind of evolve into whatever you'd like. After about a year or so of opening a store, I start to see the menu mix shift. We could start at 65-70% burgers, and by a year or two in, it could be about 45-50%, and it could be 20% sandwich, you know, 18% salad. So it does, and you see in the kitchens, when you're in the kitchens, you see the tickets, and they have a red underneath them for customization or adjustments. And obviously, we're not the only one that does that, but we kind of pride ourselves on it. I mean, honestly, I mean, you can make what kind of ever, whatever you want. So, I mean, you know, obviously that's harder on operations, but generally it's more simplified adjustments to things, you know? So, I think also one of the, not only the vegetable side component to me, non-fried is kind of cool. And I think I'm looking into more, hey, you know, what varieties in bakery are even there. There's a knotted pretzel bun we're testing right now. That's, everyone's done a pretzel bun. This is very unique. It's almost like a challah bread. So it's not out there. And that'll probably be on our calendar next year. It's doing very well. It's got a pub ale mustard. It's pretty straightforward, but we're looking at, so not only that, we're looking at cheeses that are a little bit more aged white cheddar. We've utilized Tillamook a few times, and I'm not advertising for them, but they have very quality cheeses. We've done pepper jack. So we're stepping into a little bit more elevation in terms of how and what things look like in the menu quality aspects, which also allows you to get a little bit more better price point entry, better margins, obviously, which we're all looking for.
You mean, so you can charge more for something that has sort of more premium messaging, like Tillamook Cheddar or something like that?
Yes. Yeah, I think definitely. I call it entry point pricing. And, you know, pretty much everything I show, because we do about 4 to 6 tastings a year of innovation tastings. I mean, we do various other things, but that's just more if we're changing a product or whatever. But when we do the tastings, compare the category margins, the food cost, all of that is put into, I build what's called a brief, and you know that, but that is largely, don't introduce anything that's under margin, and try to see what you can do with entry point pricing, test the limits a little bit. You know, we have a great pastrami that we've built. It's not on our menu now. Obviously the price went way up on that, but that we're looking at that kind of thing also at a higher price point. You can get a little bit more for something like that. But you know, I try to keep the balance. I mean, you can't put something on, you know, a sandwich. Some of the stuff you get for what we do would be $12.99 at places. I mean, with the Cheesecake Factory, it'd be $13, $15. I mean, so we're doing the same food in a lot of ways at a better medium price point than I think, than people think.
How do you do that?
Well, it's part of it is trying to work closely with the purchasing body and looking ahead. So part of it's looking ahead. I mean, so like I said, I feel pretty comfortable that we've written the 2023 calendar to the end of the year. Now that's subject to change, of course, obviously. That's like everybody else. But having written it, you know, and even having initiated calls as soon as this week, we can start planning our feet on the purchasing side, which helps. And then, you know, obviously now it's tumultuous, it's up in the air. And then the other part of it is our volumes are good. So we get the benefit of the volume, which does help. So it helps because the throughput and volume are good, and the average unit volumes are very good. So you gather the benefits of somewhat with labor and food costs because of that. If you're slow and you're not doing a lot of AUV, you got to be careful. You know, one has to be careful with that. So I don't know if I really answered your question, but I mean, that kind of how we look at it.
Yeah, I mean, you if you do volume, you don't need massive margins. You just need positive margins.
Yes.
And does it help being part of Yum? Or I mean, you guys are so small compared to the rest of the Yum brands, and your ingredients, I would guess, are quite a bit premium compared to a lot of Yum brand stuff.
Let me think about how to answer that. I mean, I think it's maybe not so much as our ingredients are more premium. I mean, certainly, they may in some respects be, but you know, the brands, you know, they have the three brands I've gotten involved with, you know, the three other brands on the restaurant side are really pride themselves on an execution and different things. But I would say one thing is that we are so much smaller. I mean, we're trying to make an advantage in purchasing with them. They're very good at that. They have a purchasing group. They're a wonderful organization. Everyone I've met is just top notch. But yeah, it's a little different learning experience for both of us. But I think that they're patient and we're patient, and we, you know, obviously the growth pattern will be there. We don't have a lot of matchup SKUs. That's one thing that is a little different, being that they have the chicken, they have the pizza, and they have the Taco Bell. Mm-hmm. And then now we have a burger. There's a burger chain. So a burger brand. So it is different in terms of trying to assimilate, which everyone's working hard at to gain benefits as it grows. I mean, obviously, we're exploring that on a weekly, monthly basis. But I wouldn't say it's like very, very vastly different. I mean, the purchasing body is pretty good in terms of what types of things we are looking for and who are certified through, you know, Yum Brands Network. So, and they're, you know, QA and all of that. So, you know, it's good. It's been a learning experience for everybody. And assimilation is another word I'll reuse, but it's been great. I mean, everyone's trying to help each other. There would be a lot better leverage, I'm sure, as we really exponentially grow here in the future. So, yep.
Does Yum Brands purchasing clout help you guys? I mean, the purchasing department, the Yum Brands purchasing group, I'm sure knows everybody. It certainly can't hurt to, you know.
No, it does, very much so, I believe. I mean, we have weekly calls, my team, and we have product showings for opportunities, typically every month or so. But the purchasing group is a very strong and knowledgeable group, and I would say yes to that, because it may not be right now, but it definitely will be as in forthcoming with substantial growth. So,
well, and how many Habit Grill locations are there now?
What's that?
How many Habit Burger Grill locations are there now?
Oh, to date, I don't, under 400. I don't know the exact number, because I'd have to look at that.
Right, new ones are opening all the time. Yeah, the ballpark.
It's under 400 right now.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, you guys have introduced a wide variety of different products or marketed. I don't know if they're brand new, but at the beginning of the year, you had your patty melt.
Yep,
which is on toasted corn rye bread. Speaking of fancy bakery items.
Delicious item. Very straightforward. Double cheese. You know, the traditional build for a patty melt, you know?
Yeah. Caramelized onions, Thousand Island dressing.
Yeah. I mean, go think it. Of all the wacky things I've come up with, that one's knocking it out of the park, right? Sometimes the simplest things can be better received.
Yeah, you know, especially with things like, well, chicken sandwiches in particular, I've heard they don't want a lot of bells and whistles on their chicken sandwich. They just want a chicken sandwich. And
they do. I mean, pickles, some people don't even want sauce. They just want the, you know, our actual grilled chicken sandwich, you know, we hand fillet and marinate that. It is actually so versatile. It's we have a chicken club, which is a more formal build, but our chicken sandwich is the number one sandwich, because you can get it on anything: wheat, seeded, plain. You can get it on the ciabatta, sourdough, whatever, barbecue sauce, teriyaki, whatever you want on it. I mean, that is kind of become a, you don't know what chicken sandwich you're really selling, because there are different people gravitate to different offerings. But it's all prompted by operations does an incredible job of training. And our training department, and you know, you walk up and they give you opportunity, you know, they offer, they being the cashiers and the managers, that offer you things. Okay, oh, what do you want it on? Oh, do you want this sauce? What can I get? So, and people like that. So it's not a standard chicken sandwich, the grilled one. Now, of course, the fried one is. It's pretty straightforward: pickles, mayonnaise, lettuce, tomato, and if you want to add something, you can add it. So,
and cringes.
I don't know where you got that. That's so funny. I haven't heard that term in like a year and a half. I almost forgot about that term, to be honest with you.
And it's adding little crumbles of those tempura flakes, yeah, to the outside in the process, and then you have,
yeah, it's a crispy chicken sandwich. I mean, it has a nice, you know, and ours is not, it's about 5.5 ounces. Ours is not like some of the others are much smaller that I've seen out there, which that is what it is. But yeah, I mean, the crunch on, and we lightly steam the bun, like you would for, like we do for our kids burger, just kids like that kind of glossy look, and it's softer. But we typically, it's served on our actual plain bun, sponge dough. And it's it's a good sandwich. For it is a good sandwich. So.
Well, that's interesting that you steam it to soften it up, which, you know, we don't want to have to fight with a bun while we're eating food. We want it to kind of.
Oh, you don't want to. You don't want to have to don't battle with the bun.
No, but it's also interesting that your customers are sort of customizing their dishes with sauces, which seems sort of like where a lot of chain restaurant chefs are going anyway, that, you know, it might be hard to do really complicated innovation when you have limited staff, but you can bring in an extra sauce and squirt the sauce on top, and that,
yeah,
and yeah, that can create news and get people excited.
Yeah, I mean, we do. I look at it like three different ways. One is, you know, there's always pretty standard great items from major dressing and sauce suppliers. And then there's like new news or something more custom that kind of you tailor. And then there's speed scratch items that we do in the back of the house. I mean, we make like our cilantro lime, sriracha cilantro lime sauce is made in the back of the house. It's, you know, nothing we couldn't do in our apartment or home, but it's just adds a little bit of a touch to it. We'll take a barbecue sauce and add something to it. We'll do some simple prep in the back that gives it a little bit of a spin. But yeah, there's different ways to look at that. And it's like you said, it's pretty easy to bring something in that's got great flavor and help, and it's not like this massive project to to get it into 400 restaurants or whatever it may be.
So. Yeah, they already know how to put sauce on something. You just have to give them the bottle and tell them how much.
Sometimes. So awesome. Yeah. So
the thing currently on the menu is the char-grilled peach salad, right? That's kind of the star of the summer, maybe.
It is. And my goal is to have a star, what I call a star salad, every summer. Been pretty fortunate with, we did a really nice strawberry balsamic salad with, we did dried blueberries once, we did and toasted almonds, and then we just take our strawberry puree and fold it into our balsamic dressing as a dressing. We've done the asparagus I'd mentioned, which we had never done. And then the peaches, which we had never done. I'm working on some things next year that I think will be, again, another level salad for us. But we've typically done pretty well in focusing on, you know, seasonality is kind of, it's sometimes abstract term, but in regards to the summer and the salad, try to pair up those. Burger months typically like May, and it falls good for sandwiches. So, you know, we kind of keep that balance with what you'd call seasonality.
Yeah. I mean, it does. It's funny, seasonality. It kind of depends on where the items are from. And, peach season varies from one part of the country to the next. So
it does. It does. And so does, you know, I mean, asparagus necessarily could be used all year. Right. I mean, strawberries, obviously, you know, the peak of the May, June, July, that area. We've done hatch chili in August, September, where they harvest, mainly is when they harvest that. So artichokes, something I'm looking into right now, that not a canned artichoke, but a more gourmet version of an artichoke. That's something I think fits us really well, but, you know, obviously we're a West Coast brand, so it's
artichokes very West Coast.
Yeah, Castroville.
Yes.
So yeah, just like garlic. So it's very. It's a good committee, a team that focuses on these items with me. And obviously I create the items, but if you have a group that agrees on things and, you know, you can really get ahead a little bit, and that helps with a number of things, especially these days when you don't know what you're going to get, and you know, you don't know what shortages you're going to get at any given time. Deliveries might not show up, and there's so many different things going on right now. It's unprecedented in my career. So.
Yeah, remember when you could just ask for something and you were very, very likely to get it. And now
I can get anything. It was funny. People always ask me, hey, can you get this? I can get anything you want. But at the same time, now it's different. So it's challenging too. And you have to be really careful about the pricing and the costs are just outlandish right now in terms of some of the stuff I've seen over the years. That is what everyone else is facing. So
the way it is. So we are going to see more non-fried vegetable kind of stuff for you guys. It sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. Yeah, I think we have some focus on an area that we have some opportunity. There's some interesting things that we've, I guess, in some time, somewhat, I should say, a bit surprising, but when we did the garlic, Brussels sprouts, that was the first that kind of opened the door. So, we'll see where we go with that.
Yeah. Well, and it's not something that you see in a lot of fast casual restaurants. So
no,
it's not.
Cool.
And it's good to know they perform.
Yes.
Well, Adam Baird, we're about out of time. So thank you a lot for taking the time.
Hey, thanks. Brett.
I hope we do it again soon.
Yeah.